In many cases, especially in great city-states, the population of slaves and unenfranchised strangers greatly outnumbered the citizens, but for them the state existed only by courtesy. It existed legally for the select body of citizens alone. It might or might not tolerate the outsider and the slave, but they had no legal voice in their treatment, any more than if it had been a despotism. This is a social structure differing widely from that of the Eastern monarchies. The exclusive importance of the Greek citizen reminds one a little of the exclusive importance of the children of Israel in the later Jewish state, but there's no equivalent on the Greek side to the prophets and priests, nor to the idea of an overruling Jehovah. Another contrast between the Greek states and any of the human communities to which we've hitherto given attention is their continuous and incurable division. The civilizations of Egypt, Sumeria, China, and no doubt North India all began in a number of independent city-states, each one a city with a few miles of dependent agricultural villages and cultivation around it, but out of this phase they passed by a process of coalescence into kingdoms and empires. But to the very end of their independent history, the Greeks didn't coalesce. Commonly, this is ascribed to the geographical conditions under which they lived. Greece is a country cut up into a multitude of valleys by mountain masses and arms of the sea that render intercommunication difficult. So difficult that few cities were able to hold many of the others in subjection for any length of time. Moreover, many Greek cities were on islands and scattered along remote coasts. To the end, the largest city-states of Greece remained smaller than many English counties, and some had an area of only a few square miles. Athens, one of the largest of the Greek cities, at the climax of its power, had a population of perhaps a third of a million. Few other Greek cities exceeded 50,000. Of this, half or more were slaves and strangers, and two-thirds of the free body, women and children. Third, the government of these city-states varied very widely in its nature. As they settled down after their conquests, the Greeks retained for a time the rule of their kings, but these kingdoms drifted back more and more to the rule of the aristocratic class. In Sparta, Lacedaemon, kings were still distinguished in the 6th century BC. The Lacedaemonians had a curious system of a double kingship, two kings, drawn from different royal families, ruled together. But most of the Greek city-states had become aristocratic republics long before the 6th century. There is, however, a tendency towards slackness and inefficiency in most families that rule by hereditary right. Sooner or later, they decline. And as the Greeks got out upon the seas and set up colonies, and commerce extended, new rich families arose to jostle the old and bring new personalities into power. These nouveau riches became members of an expanded ruling class, a mode of government known as oligarchy, in opposition to aristocracy, though strictly the term oligarchy, that means government by the few, should of course include hereditary aristocracy as a special case. In many cities, persons of exceptional energy, taking advantage of some social conflict or class grievance, secured a more or less irregular power in the state. This combination of personality and opportunity has occurred in the United States of America, for example, where men exercising various kinds of informal power are called bosses. In Greece, they were called tyrants. But the tyrant was rather more than a boss. He was recognized as a monarch and claimed the authority of a monarch. The modern boss, on the other hand, shelters behind legal forms which he's got hold of and uses for his own ends. Tyrants were distinguished from kings who claimed some sort of right, some family priority, for example, to rule. They were supported perhaps by the poorer class with a grievance. Pisistratus, for example, who was tyrant of Athens, with two intervals of exile between 560 and 527 BC, was supported by the poverty-struck Athenian hillmen. Sometimes, as in Greek Sicily, the tyrant stood for the rich against the poor. When later on the Persians began to subjugate the Greek cities of Asia Minor, they set up pro-Persian tyrants. Aristotle, the great philosophical teacher who was born under the hereditary Macedonian monarchy and who was for some years tutor to the king's son, distinguishes in his Politics between kings who ruled by an admitted and inherent right, such as the king of Macedonia, whom he served, and tyrants who ruled without the consent of the governed. As a matter of fact, it's hard to conceive of a tyrant ruling without the consent of many, and the active participation of a substantial number of his subjects, and the devotion and unselfishness of your true kings has been known to rouse resentment and questioning. Aristotle was also able to say that while the king ruled for the good of the state, the tyrant ruled for his own good. Upon this point, as in his ability to regard slavery as a natural thing and to consider women unfit for freedom and political rights, Aristotle was in harmony with the trend of events about him. A third form of government that prevailed increasingly in Greece in the 6th, 5th, and 4th centuries BC was known as democracy. As the modern world nowadays is constantly talking of democracy, and as the modern idea of democracy is something widely different from the democracy of the Greek city-states, it will be well to be very explicit upon the meaning of democracy in Greece. Democracy then was governed by the commonalty, the demos. It was governed by the whole body of the citizens, by the many, as distinguished from the few. But let the modern reader mark that word, citizen. The slave was excluded. The freedman was excluded. The stranger. Even the Greek born in the city, whose father had come 8 or 10 miles from the city beyond the headland, was excluded. The earlier democracies, but not all, demanded a property qualification from the citizen, and property in those days was land. This was subsequently relaxed, but the modern reader will grasp that here was something very different from modern democracy. At the end of the 5th century BC, this property qualification had been abolished in Athens, for example, but Pericles, a great Athenian statesman, of whom we shall have more to tell later, had established a law in 451 BC restricting citizenship to those who could establish Athenian descent on both sides. Thus, in the Greek democracies, quite as much as in the oligarchies, the citizens formed a close corporation, ruling sometimes, as in the case of Athens in its great days, a big population of serfs, slaves, and outlanders. A modern politician used to the idea, the entirely new and different idea, that democracy in its perfected form means that every adult man and woman shall have a voice in the government, would, if suddenly spirited back to the extremist Greek democracy, regard it as a kind of oligarchy. The only real difference between a Greek oligarchy and a Greek democracy was that in the former, the poorer and less important citizens had no voice in the government, and in the latter, every citizen had. Aristotle, in his Politics, betrays very clearly the practical outcome of this difference. Taxation set lightly on the rich in the oligarchies, the democracies, on the other hand, taxed the rich, and generally paid the impecunious citizen a maintenance allowance and special fees. In Athens, fees were paid to citizens even for attending the General Assembly. But the generality of people outside the happy order of citizens worked and did what they were told, and if one desired the protection of the law, one sought a citizen to plead for one, for only the citizen had any standing in the law courts. The modern idea that anyone in the state should be a citizen would have shocked the privileged democrats of Athens profoundly. One obvious result of this monopolization of the state by the class of citizens was that the patriotism of these privileged people took an intense and narrow form. They'd form alliances, but never coalesce with other city-states. That would have obliterated every advantage by which they lived. The narrow geographical limits of these Greek states added to the intensity of their feeling. A man's love for his country was reinforced by his love for his native town, his religion, and his home, for these were all one. Of course, the slaves didn't share in these feelings. and in the oligarchic states, very often, the excluded class got over its dislike of foreigners in its greater dislike of the class at home which oppressed it.